calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And a beautiful Monday to you today, 1963. Martin Luther King delivered his I Have a Dream speech. We will be hearing a clip of Dr. King a little later on in the program. Welcome back to our, program here. Tom Hartman with you, he that would make his own liberty secure must guard even his enemy from oppression. For if he violates this duty, he establishes a precedent that will reach to himself. That from Thomas Paine, our quote for the day. Wesley J. Smith is with us. His website, wesleyjsmith.com, appropriately enough. He's an attorney and author of a new book, Forced Exit, Euthanasia, Assisted Suicide, and the new Duty to Die. Duty to Die, Wesley J. Smith?
Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, yeah, there is something in which I write about in that book called Futile Care Theory, which is sweeping this country and, in fact, is roiling Texas because they have a law that permits it, in which if a person wants life-sustaining medical treatment and the bioethics committee of the hospital doesn't think that the quality of their life is worth living, then they want to be able to, these people who support futile care theory, refuse wanted life-sustaining treatment on that basis. So, yes, duty to die is something to consider. And, in fact, whether or not we have a so-called duty to die is being actively discussed in bioethics discourse.
But the issue at the legal level in the United States has only appeared in Oregon, which is
We're not talking about assisted suicide. We're talking about futile care theory, medical futility, where people who want life-sustaining treatment, and it's happening in Texas. If you go do a Google search, medical futility, you'll get all kinds of Texas cases where doctors and bioethics committees and permitted by Texas law are refusing wanted life-sustaining treatment that people want to maintain their lives. So it is not the same thing as assisted suicide. It's a first cousin to assisted suicide, but it's a different public policy.
But you're opposed to physician-assisted suicide as well.
Of course.
And yet here in Oregon, our experience has been, and I've had a couple of people on this program who are very involved with they call it the Death with Dignity program.
I know that's what they call it. That's a euphemism, so go ahead.
Who have said that the number of suicides has actually gone down. What happens is that people are given life-ending medication. First of all, they have to have two doctors sign off on the fact that they're terminal within 6 months. And they get the medication and sit it on the, you know, on the counter next to the bed. And now they know that they have the ability to take their own lives. And so every day they say, well, I can put up with this for one more day and one more day and one more day. And the percentage of people who actually die natural deaths and the percentage of it has gone up and the percentage of people who commit suicide has actually gone down because people feel like they now have control over their own future. Why would you want the state to stick its nose in our business and tell us that we can't have control over our future like that?
Well, first off, you don't know what the heck is going on in Oregon because the only thing you know about the assisted suicide practice up there is what the death doctors, that is the doctors who write lethal prescriptions, tell the state.
I live here.
So you want to listen to an answer or do you want to interrupt?
Conversation involved an occasional interruption. What, am I supposed to let you give a speech?
You're supposed to let me say more than one sentence at a time, because what you're talking about, you don't know about. You're making some kind of anecdotal statement, when in fact, nobody really knows what's going on in Oregon, because the state conducts no independent investigation.
So you have come to Oregon and done a study?
And indeed destroys the documents as soon as they publish their yearly annual reports. So you don't know what's happening. Plus in Oregon, I don't know if you've noticed, pal, but you guys are having a terrible problem with elder suicide. You're having a terrible problem with youth suicide. So don't tell me suicide's going down in Oregon.
So you've come to Oregon and done a study, Wesley J. Smith?
I have read the studies that have actually been done, my friend. I have read the headlines in your papers bemoaning the fact, why would elderly people be killing themselves? Gee, I have no idea. Maybe because the state has said suicide is acceptable in some circumstances.
You've
got to know what you're talking about to interview me, so go ahead.
I just don't get it. Why you want the state telling me that criminal sanctions are going to come after me or anybody who helps me if I decide that at the end of my life, in great pain, knowing that I am terminal, I decide to leave a few weeks early.
Well, first off, that's not even what the assisted suicide advocates in Oregon say is happening. It's not about pain. If you've been reading the reports, pain is not the issue. That's how assisted suicide is sold. That's how people are scared into accepting the idea of assisted suicide, that it will be a last resort when nothing can be done to alleviate unbearable suffering. That's a false premise. You've got the hospice movement. You've got good pain control. There are things that people can do and should do.
Well, let's say I'm not in pain.
Why don't you let me finish a sentence? Maybe your audience would be able to learn something. And maybe you would learn something. You invited me on your show, and if you want to hear what
you solicited us to be on the show.
It's called courtesy, my friend. Courtesy. You invited me on as your guest, so let me speak. So if you want to go ahead and tell me what you think, go ahead. Your audience hears it all the time, so be my guest. Have fun. I'll listen.
Again.
Go ahead.
What if I'm trying to understand why you want the government to be coming into my house with the force of guns. I mean, you know, the government with the force of the government has the ability to use, you know, to use guns and put people in prison. Why you want the force of law to be used against me if I decide it's the end of my life? And let's even say I'm not in pain, but I'm going to die within a month or so, and there's no doubt about that, and I decide I'm going to leave early.
Well,
Why is that the government's business?
First off, the purpose of government is to protect the lives of all citizens. Secondly, there are study after study that show, for example, people with cancer who may want assisted suicide today, 3 weeks later are really glad they didn't commit it. It should be the government's job to engage in suicide prevention in all cases, not say, well, some suicides we agree with, and some suicides we don't. The intellectual premise of the two premises of the assisted suicide movement are as follows. Number one, what you've been talking about, this is my body, I own it, I can do what I want, personal autonomy. The second is that death can be an acceptable answer to personal suffering. So if those are the premises, what in the world does dying have to do with it? There are an awful lot of people who are suffering, quite particularly with existential suffering, that are going to suffer for far more intensely and far longer than dying people. This whole concept that it's going to be limited to the terminally ill is ridiculous when you think about it in the long term. And indeed, when you look at what's happened in the Netherlands over the last 33 years since they've been permitting this, they've now gotten to the point where doctors are assisting the suicides of people who are disabled, chronically ill, even depressed. So the idea that killing can be an acceptable answer to human suffering and the state should validate that is very dangerous. Secondly, the states throughout this country, and I'm sure still in Oregon, other than if somebody has cancer, can prevent suicide and can prevent suicide not through criminal processes against the suicidal person who needs help, but through psychiatric.
No, I get all that, but you're suggesting that the purpose of government is not to protect our freedoms, but is to protect our health. If that's the case, Wesley Smith, why aren't you out campaigning tirelessly for national health care?
Actually, you don't know how I feel about national health care. I think we do need to improve access to health care for people who do not have access to it. I don't think that NHS like in the UK, socialized medical system, will work. The NHS is collapsing, but I do think we need to have a combination of a private sector and public sector campaign or program so that people who are uninsured will be greatly reduced in number and more people have access to quality health care. I think that's a big crisis in this country.
Okay.
And is also a relevant issue in terms of assisted suicide.
And just for the record, you're suggesting to me that the physicians that I've spoken with on this program, on the radio, from Oregon here, who at least one of whom has never written a prescription for life-ending medication, who say that the statistics show that the number of people who are committing suicide, particularly elderly people, but also younger people who are terminal, has actually declined since we put into case physician-assisted suicide, that they're just making it up or they're lying.
The people committing suicide in Oregon declining, I have certainly seen no reports on that. What I have seen is, if you take a look, do a Google search of despair over the elderly.
Why would these guys lie about this?
I'm not saying they did lie. I don't know what they said. You might have misinterpreted.
I will tell you what they said. They said that people who get prescriptions for physician-assisted suicide. Are you not going to let me finish my sentence, sir?
Go ahead.
They said that it works both ways, right? They said that the number of people, when people get prescriptions for life-ending drugs, they are less likely to end up committing suicide. Before, it used to be that they'd shoot themselves.
Well, I have not heard those statistics. I'd love for somebody to send those to me, but it doesn't matter because what matters is...
It
doesn't matter.
Because it's all about your morality.
No, it's not about my morality. It's about public morality. You guys have made your decision in terms of your vote on Proposition 16, and you had your legalized assisted suicide. Someday you're going to rescind it because it's a terrible public policy. In the meantime, as assisted suicide advocates try to spread it around the country, we're resisting it, and we resisted it for more than 13 years. Maybe you ought to interview Greg Hamilton from Physicians for Compassionate Care in Oregon, who is a psychiatrist, who has written the only peer-reviewed article about a person who got poison prescription, and that man got the poison prescription 2 years before he died a natural death and was allowed to keep the poison prescription even though he was delusional.
Right. In other words, he didn't use it. That's the whole point. In other words, he didn't use it. WesleyJSmith.com, the website. People want to learn more about it. Thanks for being with us today. 17 minutes past the hour on the Tom Hartmann Program.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartmann.
Suicide is painless. It brings on many changes. And I can take or leave it if I please.
And welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. I gotta tell you, one of these days we're gonna have to have a contest for the rudest right winger. I think Wesley J. Smith would win. I was having a hard time to stop laughing. I mean, it's just, hey, you were invited on this. Excuse me. You solicited us to be on our program, sir. But nonetheless, isn't it amazing these guys? Oh, we're all about freedom. We're all about liberty. But you better not do something in the privacy of your own home we don't like. Like having sex with somebody the same gender, or smoking pot, or committing suicide when you're terminally ill. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number, 866-440-8466. Ralph in Olympia, Washington. Hey, Ralph, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. This may be a little tough, but my father was a Lieutenant Colonel Army Chaplain. He and my mother are both buried in Arlington National Cemetery. My father was the administrative chaplain at Fort Snelling when the first Army chapel was ever built. He was largely responsible for raising all of the funds for it.
Mm-hmm.
My father was incredibly ethical and moral with all of the decisions that he made. He's one of the finest men I ever knew. Dad, in his final days, had to go to the VA hospital in Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm.
He and my mother had talked extensively about just kind of going. Dad had written an article for the Watchman Examiner entitled Back from the Valley of the Shadow of Death. And in it he said, I don't have any fear of death. I've done my stuff. I feel comfortable with meeting my maker.
Right.
The United States Army in the Veterans Administration Hospital kept my father alive for 2 years. Dad was being fed through a tube down into his stomach, and he pulled it out of his nose several times. They tied his arms down to the slats of the bed.
Oh, man. In other words, he had reached the point where he did not want to live any longer.
Yes.
And they forced him to...
They forced him to live. And I have had to relive that damn thing ever since the Terry Schiavo thing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. say.
There are a host of us, I suspect, who are out there who have had similar types of experiences. When I listen to the arrogant vomit of that particular individual that you just had on, I am disgusted.
Yeah, I agree with you, Ron.
Because he can't even hold a candle to my father.
Yes, yes. Ralph, thank you for sharing your story with us.
Yeah, I kind of hope it has an impact.
I suspect it has. Ralph, thank you very much.
Take care.
You too. Joe in Provo, Utah. Hey, Joe.
Hey, Tom. You know, they want to apply laws to people that want to freely apply themselves to their lives and their destiny, but they refuse to apply themselves to the laws that exist when we apply our force on people against their will. I mean, you know, I'm a Vietnam vet. I live with the fact that we slaughtered 5 million people in Cambodia, Laos, and Vietnam with weapons of mass destruction. You know, and it was illegal what we were doing.
Mm-hmm.
And where were people like him when it comes time to dealing with life and death situations when it's illegal?
Yeah, well, the bottom line is I think an awful lot of this is being driven, frankly, out of the Vatican, out of the Catholic Church, which believes that suicide is a sin. And they want to keep us from sinning. And if they have to come into our homes and hospitals with guns to stop us from sinning, they're going to do it.
Well, I'll tell you, you know, I've gotten to the point with religion. I grew up Catholic, and then I went to synagogue to study in a synagogue for a while. And you know, religion has meant a lot to my life, but I've gotten to the point where if religion is about world peace, what's the point? I don't have any room for it in my life. I'm tired of all this religion.
And, you know, really that was the fundamental teaching of Jesus, who, you know, the founder, arguably, of Christianity. Joe, good point. Thank you very much. Will in Pittsburgh. Hey, Will, we have about a minute left. What's up?
Who was that moron that called you? What was
his name was Wesley J. Smith, which is also his website.
Who does he work for, Tom?
I don't know. He's an attorney with the Discovery Institute, and he solicited our program to be on. And, you know, I knew he was a right-winger and put him on, you know, and he goes, all right. He's written a new book. It's called Forced Exit, Euthanasia, Assisted Suicide, and the New Duty to Die.
Carmine, I only have, about 30 seconds?
Yeah.
Let me tell you something. My father went through that, and I think every person has a right to take their own life when they're terminally ill, and not just because they're in pain. You realize the economic genocide that in this country that healthcare inflicts upon us.
Oh yeah, the hospitals want to extract the last dollar. You know, they keep you alive for another 5 days. They get another 5 days worth of money from you. Will, thanks a lot for the money or for the call. I appreciate it. 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
I keep a close watch on this heart of mine. I keep my eyes wide open all the time. I keep the ends out for the tie that binds. Because you're mine, I walk the line.
And welcome back. Talk radio for the rest of us. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. I drop into our live chat room at TomHartman.com, our toll-free number, 866-440-8466, all across the United States of America. By the way, we've recorded a audiobook bit. My new book is out, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What You Can Do About It, and What We Can Do About It. And we recorded Chapter 7, which is a chapter about Bush's use of Hitler's techniques. And you know, I recorded it basically like a book on tape, and there's little clips in there of Eisenhower and of Hess introducing Hitler, actually. And it's over at 620kpoj.com if you want to hear it. It's free. You can download it. You can iPod it, whatever you'd like. It's an MP3 file. Just go to 620kpoj.com, which is the radio station where I do a morning show before I do this live national show. Angela in York, Pennsylvania on the line. Hey, Angela, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Tom.
Yeah.
Your guest that you had on.
Yeah.
You blew it. The issue that he started talking about was something that I think needs debate, and you asked him about assisted suicide. He started talking about another issue that really is something that's bothered me for a while that I've heard about, and that's where, especially in the state of Texas, where it's legal, doctors or these, what do you call them, biogenetic committees can decide whether or not you as a person are allowed to have the life-sustaining treatment you requested. There was a very small blurb in the media when the Schiavo case was out there about a woman in Texas who wanted that type of treatment for her son and was turned down because of that law.
Now, I understand that, and that's an area where he and I are probably not in disagreement. The area, and having looked over his book, I got it that he's absolutely against physician-assisted suicide. In fact, that's a large, probably 90% of his book is all about how physician-assisted suicide, as we have here in Oregon, inevitably leads to euthanasia. And the news hook that he's trying to use is the story in Texas. And so, no, I didn't blow it. I talked about what I wanted to talk about, which is these guys want to legislate against physician-assisted suicide. They're using the Texas situation, where we probably agree, as the wedge. And you know, so...
But let me ask you this, Tom.
Yeah.
The issue of physician-assisted suicide, it's almost in that realm of the all-or-nothing debate with abortion. Don't you think that it's important also to get these other issues out there that other people might not even be aware of? And, you know, it's certainly more difficult once such a problem spreads to do something about it.
Yeah, I don't disagree. I don't disagree, but I'll tell you, this is the issue really where these guys are going to make their stand. And what Oregon has done right now, John Ashcroft filed a lawsuit against the state back when he was attorney general. It got knocked down, you know, by the Supreme Court. They didn't let it go through. But the Bush administration's been doing everything they can to try and take down a law that was passed not once, but twice by the citizens of Oregon because the legislature didn't have the courage. It was passed by citizen initiative. And I'm telling you, when people get upset about something, they will stand up and fix it. And that's what happened in this state. And there's been this unrelenting, unremitting attack on it. And he and his book and his whole bunch are part of that. And they have a huge ally in the healthcare industry that would love to have people, you know, I mean, the longer you're in the hospital, the more money it makes for the hospital. And now that hospitals are for-profit businesses, and Bill Frist's daddy is one of the 50 richest men in America because of Hospital Corporation of America, there's big money in keeping people alive who don't want to stay alive. So that's that. Angela, thanks a lot for the call. I mean, that was the fundamental that I wanted to discuss with him, and I brought it back to that. Jason in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Jason.
Oh, hey, I was just calling. I just wanted to make a comment. I only caught bits and pieces of what you guys were talking about. Is this guy a religious guy or?
Well, he doesn't make religious arguments, but yeah, I can't speak for him. I don't have any idea. He's doing the Catholic line, but I don't know.
Yeah, okay. Well, I just think that people just need to get off this stupid high horse and worry about things that really matter. Just,
yeah, his news release, you know, goes on at length about how in Holland now, I think it was about 30 or 40 babies last year were euthanized. But then when you dig a little deeper, in other words, they were put to death after they were born, you dig a little deeper in the statistics, you discover that a quarter of those babies were not expected to live more than a week or two, and the majority of them were not expected to live more than a year. And here in the United States, we would keep them alive until they died. In Holland, they say, okay, that's it. Now, that's another area where it would be interesting to have a discussion. But
we're talking about elderly people and terminally ill people in Oregon, and this is not...
That's right. I was going to say, the issue that's real, where the rubber meets the road, is physician-assisted suicide. That's, in my opinion, that's the issue that we really need to be having a discussion about in the United States. And the cons don't even want us having that discussion, much less, God forbid, Jason, you and I here in Oregon having that law. So, anyhow, thanks.
Well, I mean, it just goes on to one more thing. It just goes on to the whole thing about religion and getting in way of our own rights and what we want. It's our body. Let's do what we want. I mean,
yeah.
Give me a break.
Yeah. Thanks, Jason. Well said. Fred in Springfield, Oregon. Hey, Fred.
Yes, hi. I think you made a good point, too, about this man's motives. I'd like to know sometimes what these people's real motives are for objecting to certain things. I mean, like... in the saving fetuses' lives, are they only into it because perhaps they're really into having these babies available for adoptions, and they want to make sure that they've got enough available for them?
Well, you've got what's his name, John, I forget his last name, the commentator on Fox News the other day saying white people have more babies.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, you know, they're hysterical about this.
That's right. And a few years back, about 10 years or more ago, they had a big issue in the magazines and papers about how the white population was dwindling. And at that time, I got to thinking, you know, because the same thing was going on with the abortion issue. Why were they caring so much? Are they so afraid that the white population is dwindling? They've got to figure out a way to force whites to have more babies.
Well, I think there are some, like John Gibson of Fox News, who are into that. There are others who think that this is what their religion dictates. It's not in the Bible, but the Pope says it, and therefore it must be, God's will. Save us from people who are certain that they know God's will. Fred, thanks a lot for the call. Julian in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hey, Julian.
Yeah, hi. I was kind of interested in the guy's original point and the fact he's getting his information from Texas, which I believe is a Republican state.
Yeah.
Am I wrong on that?
Yeah.
So you would think that they would have more conservative values and they wouldn't want to put people to death before the people want to die.
Well, it's not a matter of putting people to death. It's a matter of letting people die.
Well, yeah, but in Texas, it's if I understood him, he's saying patients actually don't want to die yet, and they want treatment, and doctors are refusing to give them treatment.
I'm going to have to dig into that a little more, Julian, before I can really speak about it. I'm not qualified to speak on that. Chris in Seattle. Hey, Chris, a Buddhist slant on this discussion?
Yeah, I just kind of wanted to just put it out there. Real quick, I just wanted to say about the, have more white people, have more babies. It just shows...
That was John Gibson's thing.
I didn't hear it, but it just shows that, racism and discrimination and bigotry, all that stuff is still prevalent. It's just gotten more undercover. It's just gotten more incognito. But I wouldn't, in people's minds, I wouldn't say it's, I'm sure, it's way better than the, civil rights movement. But I also I just wanted to comment that, racism on all sides is totally prevalent, And I hate to see so much, coverage of racism with white, when you ask, if you did a study and asked any American, just a big, huge number, what's the first thing they think of when they, think of racist or whatever? They're going to say neo-Nazi or KKK or something. I'll get to my quick point. I just wanted to point out that although the Buddhist, at least Tibetan, that I'm a part of, they believe that suicide is the most negative effect you could have on your being as far as negative energy.
Right on your future, on your karma, as it were.
Exactly, negative energy, bad karma. But I don't know whether this would be considered that. I think some people would twist the law and, somebody that might be depressed might kill themselves, although there's plenty of ways to do it painlessly without, this. But they also would be totally against anybody telling any form, organization, even single person telling any other human being.
Yeah.
What they should do.
I got it, Chris. I got it. I appreciate it.
Now it's time for my word. Do your duty. Make more babies.
This is John Gibson.
That's a lesson drawn out of two interesting stories over the last couple of days. First, a story yesterday that half of the kids in this country under 5 years old are minorities.
Uh-oh.
By far, the greatest number are Hispanic.
Uh-oh.
You know what that means? 25 years and the majority population is Hispanic. Why is that? Well, Hispanics are having more kids, and others, notably the ones Hispanics called gabachos, white people, are having fewer.
So, John Gibson, Fox News.
The rest of you get busy. Make babies. Or put another way, a slogan for our times. Procreation, not recreation. That's my word.
Yeah, that's John Gibson's word over at Fox News. Oh, man, what a weird world we're living in. 45 minutes past the hour, exposing the con and conservative, the Tom Hartman radio program. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Remember, democracy starts with you. Tag your ears.
Okay, here's the situation. It took a few minutes to track this thing down because there's nothing that I can find about it. Texas isn't even in the index of this guy's book who was on our program, and none of the Texas information is here, although, you know, he's throwing this stuff out. Here's a piece from the Daily Texan, serving the University of Texas at Austin since 1900. Son, a six-month-old baby with lungs too tiny to breathe, was taken off a respirator at the Texas Children's Hospital in Houston earlier this month. He never would have been able to survive even if doctors had continued treatment. But the decision to let son die was made by the hospital over the objections of his mother, Wanda Hudson. This is the story. It was in the news back 6-8 months ago. When the family wants terminal patients to continue treatment and the hospital disagrees, the hospital's ethic committee has the final say. That's the way it works in Texas under a 1999 law. That would have been passed when George W. Bush was governor. The spirit of the law is not inherently cruel. It was designed so that doctors who felt it was wrong to prolong the suffering of terminal patients in obvious pain would be able to refuse treatment. It requires that in any case where the doctor wishes to remove life-sustaining care against the wishes of the next of kin, provide 10 days' notice, in which time the family may find another health care facility that will treat the patient. But in cases where the patient is clearly dying, it can be hard to find a health care facility to take on that patient for the same ethical reasons that the original hospital wished to end care, so they would not prolong suffering. So this is what it gets down to, is this kind of thing. It's going to be a tough one. 1-866-440-8466. Bob in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Hey, Bob.
How you doing, Tom? Thank you for being a voice.
Sure. What's up?
I remember hearing about the Texas Feudal Care Law, Health and Safety Code number 166, during the Terry Schiavo thing.
Yeah.
The sudden Hudson thing was happening at the same time.
Right.
And I had heard about Randy Rhodes. And I went and looked it up and printed it out. Originally, it was written that 72 hours after you ran out of Medicaid and or health insurance, the hospital can unplug you. It was all basically framed around money. It had nothing to do with whether the physician thought that you would make it or not.
So this was originally written by Bill Frist's daddy.
I guess so. You know, they're so caring and everything.
Yeah.
It infuriated me at the time. I had printed it out. It was 32 pages. I was going through a major argument with my sister and my sisters and my mother about the whole Terry Schiavo thing and how we should stay out of it. I printed it out, and they refused to read it.
Yeah. And if it was being promoted by the hospitals in the original form, you can understand why George Bush would have wanted to sign it as governor. But since then, they took out that part about the money?
No, the money's still there, only they increased it to 10 days instead of 72 hours.
Oh, man.
So that's
not good.
No, it's not good. And that was my... with them, I'm saying, as this guy's flying up from Texas to sign a law for this one, you know, breathing cabbage in Florida, and I'm saying, well, they're putting people to death and who, you know, as the son Hudson's mother was pleading to keep her child alive.
Right, although that child was going to die.
Yeah, he was born with his heart on the outside of his body.
Right.
It wasn't inside, so he wasn't going to make it. But she was pleading to at least try, you know, do something. And they just went ahead, you know, Texas Feudal Care Law, you know, George said
pull
it's
the plug.
All right.
Pull the plug. Interesting. Yeah. Bob, thanks for the tip and the heads up. I appreciate it. Kenny in West Palm Beach, Florida. Hey, Kenny.
Hey, Tom. Hi, thanks for taking my call. You made a comment, and the last two calls one reinforces one, and this past one reinforces the last one before that didn't. You, just as the commercial break was going on, you said, this hospital will keep you alive as long as possible to take all the money they can. It was kind of a quick comment. Maybe it was in the spirit of the moment, but I don't know if you really meant to say that or not.
I did mean to say that. I have had personal experience with that. And my take on it is that back when hospitals were not-for-profit organizations and most states required hospitals to be non-profit organizations, decisions were made based on what's best for the patient. And now, very often, decisions are made based on what's best for the economics of the hospital. Frankly, I don't think anybody can deny that.
Well, okay, but in maybe situations are different at different places. In my limited experience, where someone I know works, they are more pragmatic. When someone is obviously either brain dead or isn't going to survive or is just, you know, their life is being carried on unnecessarily, they aren't usually on the side of allowing the death to happen rather than prolonging.
Yeah, in other words, there are hospitals around the country that will do what Terry Schiavo's husband wanted done with Terry Schiavo, which is just let them die naturally. Yeah, no, I don't disagree with that, Kenny. I'm not saying the hospitals in all cases are extending life.
I don't think it can be
life.
Just a general statement.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thanks. Good point. Point well made. Tom in Fort Myers, Florida. Hey, Tom.
Hey, I just wanted to comment on something that was brought up a little earlier about this partially being racially motivated to a certain extent, and a lot of what Gibson was saying. I mean, granted, he's a fun nut to listen to once in a while, but you know, too many people believe what he's saying about that. And I've being in TV for 20 years, shooting video, been to many an abortion clinic protest, and a couple of towns I lived in, you know, that the white neighborhood abortion clinic, you know, Planned Parenthood, that was the one being protested, but not the one in the middle income, what would be considered, you know, lower income, racially diverse area. No, they never had protesters there.
Oh,
it was always in the white neighborhood, and I always thought that was, you know, a bit despicable of them, but, you know, and then you get Gibson saying something about, we're all going to be brown. It's like, well, good.
Yeah.
White people every day a Republican dies and the Democrat's born, you know?
It may well be. Tom, thanks a lot for the call. I don't think that we break down politically along racial lines inherently. It's just that, you know, when the Republican Party followed Richard Nixon's advice of the Southern Strategy in 72 and became the party of racism, gee, you wonder why minorities would be more inclined to be Democratic. What a surprise. Oh, my. Well, 57 minutes past the hour on the Tom Hartman radio program. Coming up after the news, Erwin Redliner of his new book, Americans at Risk. Can we deal with another disaster? 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
How could you survive a disaster? Could you survive a disaster? You know, what would happen if Katrina or something of that proportion were to hit the place where you live? Is America ready for disasters? Whether it's disasters that are human-made, as in the possibility of terrorist attack or something like that, the stuff that the Bush administration wants to endlessly hype, or the possibility, the much more likely probability of some sort of a tornado hitting you, a hurricane, an earthquake, a flood, your basic natural disasters. Erwin Redliner has a new book out. It's called Americans at Risk, Why We Are Not Prepared for Mega Disasters and What We Can Do Now. Erwin, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom. Glad to be here.
Why are we not prepared for disasters?
Oh, where can we begin? But let me start with the federal government and its, I guess, planning for disaster response or the prevention of disasters in the case of terrorism. There isn't a single area or element of homeland security or preparedness for disasters that is anywhere near where it should be. And the reasons for this, and one of the reasons I actually wrote the book, was I was just so horrified watching the unfolding events after Katrina about the astounding incompetence displayed by government that I've been thinking about this for a while. I just said that we're going to go ahead and do this, but I wanted to get to the bottom of why the federal government has been so inept in dealing with things that should be a matter of course, that a level of competency that Americans should expect from their government is just not happening at this particular point.
Well, didn't we, to a large extent, back in the 90s, during the Clinton administration, see a fairly high level of competency among FEMA, for example, which
this
had
is one, yeah, this
actually
is one
a professional director running it?
Exactly. And not only that, I mean, the FEMA world reputation was extraordinary during the Clinton administration. In fact, they had to set up an office in FEMA to receive and tour international visitors who were coming to see how to operate a state-of-the-art modern emergency response system.
Now they've moved that museum over to Comedy Central, right?
It's been just extraordinary. It's almost as if somebody had deliberately said, oh, this was really great back in the Clinton administration. Why don't we just completely destroy it?
Well, but see, there is a worldview here. I mean, you know, Ronald Reagan back in the 1980s,
yes,
came out with his famous...
I've always felt the 9 most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
And basically declared war on the idea of we the people in a constitutionally limited democratic republic, we the people caring for ourselves in any way. Care should come from wealthy people who are feeling philanthropic, or churches who are trying to save our souls, and the government should, you know, get out of the business, get out of the way. And Clinton brought back the idea of a competent government that, you know, where we the people protect ourselves from disasters and from predators and things. And, you know, 100,000 extra cops on the streets, for example. Bush comes in, he goes back to Reagan's philosophy. So, really, have a government that works if you don't believe in government.
Tom, it's worse than Reagan's philosophy. It's Reagan's philosophy with Bush's incompetence has ended up in a double whammy on our ability to deal effectively with all sorts of problems. But here we have a situation where, you know, yes, in fact, there is a very, very important role for individual citizens and communities and families to play. And you do have to think about what you would do if you were in some kind of calamity that, like we've been talking about. But you cannot, people themselves cannot do this without government. In fact, government can't do it without people. But at the end of the day, we have a situation right now where FEMA, which was extraordinary, went to, first of all, it was pushed into this new Homeland Security Department itself, highly problematic in a variety of ways, reporting to somebody who himself and Michael Chertoff has no real disaster oversight responsibility. Political appointees left and right have replaced the professionals, and now, in fact, we do have a very good guy, David Paulson, in there now, but he's got to undo some serious damage to that agency. But no matter what he does, if we don't have the old situation back that Clinton had established, where the head of FEMA reported directly to the president
as a cabinet member,
you know, what's that?
As a cabinet member.
As a cabinet member, as opposed to having to report through the bureaucracy of Homeland Security, itself highly dysfunctional as an agency.
Yeah.
So we have some structural problems to deal with here.
So are you suggesting, Erwin Redliner, the author of a new book, Americans at Risk, with a nice blurb on the front cover by Bill Clinton himself, are you suggesting that the first step is the structural step, that it should be a political step, and then through the mechanism of politics we go forward to prepare ourselves for disasters? Or are you suggesting
Tom, my first choice in what would be the very first step is establishing accountability in government. I mean, they've gone through close to $250 billion, nearly $250 billion in Homeland Security and preparedness monies since 9/11. We have no idea what we've purchased with that, or whether everything we've purchased has made us appreciably more safe or more prepared than we were before.
And this is enough money, by the way, to give full 4-year scholarships at public universities to 15 million students.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a mind-boggling amount.
Oh, it's absolutely mind-boggling. It's correct. And I think so. If you say, what do we need to do? We need to develop some level of accountability here. And the Congress, by the way, has been inept, basically, in making sure that the money that they're appropriating is going to appropriate purposes and is effectively increasing our level of preparedness.
But isn't the ultimate, you say we need to hold government accountable, isn't that called elections?
Yeah, that's what I used to call it when I was growing up. So
don't we get back to my original question, which is it's time to throw the bums out and get some people in who can actually believe in government and know how to run a government.
Well, let me put it this way. I've been working for 35 years in public programs and public health. I have never seen this level of incompetence. I have never seen this lack of accountability with this much money being expended. This is a whole new territory for
America.
But
the conservative philosophy that animates this administration believes that the greatness of a nation is measured by the power and wealth of its most powerful institutions and its richest and most powerful people. The old line, the old-fashioned American ideal that was put forth by the founders of this country and elevated by Franklin Roosevelt and Republicans like Dwight Eisenhower, is that the greatness and goodness and brilliance of a nation is actually measured by the strength of its middle class and its infrastructure.
Of course it is. Eisenhower was responsible for the interstate highway system in the United States.
But
we didn't just ask volunteers and local not-for-profit groups to kind of everybody go out and dig a little highway out there. This was a master plan to improve the functioning and the economy of the United States. This is a collective responsibility that was initiated and implemented by government.
Right, but my point is that because as long as we have people running our country, and right now the House, the Senate, and the White House, and I would argue even the Supreme Court, are all in the hands of people who believe that the quality of a nation is measured by how powerful its corporations are and how rich its very rich people are. And as long as we have that, rather than people in power in our government who believe that the quality of a nation is determined by the economic health of its middle class and the quality of its infrastructure, we're going to continue going down the road we're going down.
There's no question about it.
I mean, so it's this is a political problem.
Well, most things are a political problem. This is a political problem, writ large here, because that underlying philosophy has driven a strategy and a set of agendas that has deprofessionalized critical agencies like Homeland Security, and has basically given short shrift to all of the things that will actually make us stronger as a nation. You could start with health care. And by the way, in the book, I talk about how the problems that have been exacerbated over this last 5 or 6 years around health care actually are undermining our ability to respond to a major disaster. Our healthcare system is a mess. We have 45 million uninsured people. Where do they think these people will go if a pandemic strikes and they need to get their symptoms identified and treated early? I mean, they're locked out of the system and they become real problems. They're like the typhoid Marys of the pandemic flu era. So we have all sorts of problems that stem from a philosophy that is taking us down a really dangerous path at the moment.
So short of, and we just have just a minute left here, Erwin Redlener, the author of Americans at Risk, Why We Are Not Prepared for Mega Disasters and What We Can Do Now, short of political solutions, short of voting into people who voting into office, people who actually understand this, what else can we do?
Well, we can ask for some changes that are immediate. For example, the extraction of FEMA from Homeland Security is a no-brainer that even this Congress and White House ought to be able to imagine and fix. Coordinating and understanding of the relationship between the military and civilian authorities in responding to a disaster, another thing that's fixable. And having individual Americans know what they can do and know about to save their lives in the event of a catastrophe are all things that don't have to wait until the government has changed.
Yeah, and that goes way beyond duct tape and plastic sheeting.
Way beyond, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, you can learn all about it at Americans at Risk is the book. Erwin Redlener, the author. The website, AmericansAtRisk.com, for more information. Erwin, thanks for being with us today.
My pleasure, Tom. Thank you.
Great talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, The True People's Radio.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh, Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood. If I seem edgy, I want you to know that I never mean to take it out on you. Life has its problems, and I get my share. And that's one thing I never mean to do.
because I love you. Oh,
and welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Our program brought to you today by, in part by Sacred Grounds Coffee, saving the planet one cup at a time. Their phone number for some of the, I'm telling you, the world's best organic coffees. I mean, just great stuff. 1-800-425-2532. 1-800-425-2532 for Sacred Ground Coffee and Sacred Grounds Coffee and sacredgroundscoffee.com, of course, their website. So check it out. It's you will be. This weekend, I just binged. I wrote an op-ed for Common Dreams, and spent the whole weekend just chowing down coffee. Boy, was I was having a great time. It was great. Anyhow, let's check out right now what the situation is with the U.S. occupation of Iraq.
I want to know the men in the shadows of. I want to hear somebody asking them why. They can be counted on to tell us who our enemies are. But they're never the ones to fight and to die. And there are lights in the balance.
The following are security and other developments in Iraq reported on Monday as of 1,000 hours Greenwich Mean Time. This by Reuters. In Diwania, 25 Iraqi soldiers were killed in clashes with Shiite militiamen in that town. Five Iraqi soldiers have also gone missing in the fighting, which started on Sunday evening. In Baghdad, a suicide car bomber killed up to 16 people near an entrance to the Interior Ministry in central Baghdad. 13 of the dead were policemen, police say. 62 people were wounded, 47 of them police. In Mosul, gunmen killed three policemen and suffered attacks in that northern city. In Baghdad, a civilian was wounded when a roadside bomb went off near a police patrol in central Baghdad. Also, Defense Secretary Don Rumsfeld yesterday, this from the Associated Press, praised the work of an Army brigade whose one-year tour in Iraq was extended just as they prepared to return home, and said he saw no reason for the soldiers or their families to be angry at them, at him. This is the 172nd Striker Brigade, families at Fort Wainwright in Alaska. Reporters, by the way, who were traveling with Rumsfeld were excluded from his session with these soldiers. However, Jennifer Davis of Anchorage, whose husband is a member of the 172nd, said, since we couldn't hear what Rumsfeld had to say or what the soldiers had to say, she said, quote, she's the wife of one of the soldiers, quote, I am totally frustrated, disappointed, and heartbroken. Just when I thought we were going to be able to resume a normal life, and when I thought the nightmare was over, the nightmare was extended. Speaking of extending the nightmare, Tony Blair, as he's referred to in the United Kingdom, Tony, as in, kind of sucking up to George W., under attack from former U.S. President Jimmy Carter. The Sunday Telegraph reports, this from telegraph.co.uk, the Telegraph, the newspaper in the U.K. Telegraph reports that Jimmy Carter, in an interview with that newspaper, said, quote, I have been surprised and extremely disappointed by Tony Blair's behavior. I think that more than any other person in the world, the prime minister could have had a moderating influence on Washington, and he has not. I really thought that Tony Blair, who I know personally to some degree, would be a constraint on President Bush's policies towards Iraq. End quote. Telegraph goes on to note, Mr. Carter also said that the Iraq invasion had subverted the fight against terrorism and instead strengthened al-Qaeda and the recruitment of terrorists. He said, we now have a situation where America is so unpopular overseas that even in countries like Egypt and Jordan, our approval ratings are less than 5%. It's a shameful and pitiful state of affairs. And I hold your British Prime Minister to be substantially responsible for being so compliant and subservient. The newspaper notes the outspoken attack by the former Democratic president shows the extent of alienation between the Labor Department and its traditional Democratic Party allies in the United States. Asked why he thinks Mr. Blair has behaved in the way he has with President Bush's belligerent regime, Mr. Carter said he could only put it down to timidity. Yet he confessed that he remains baffled by the apparent contrast between Mr. Blair's private remarks and his public utterances. As Jimmy Carter said, I really believe the reports of former leaders who were present in conversations between Blair and Bush that Blair has expressed private opinions contrary to some of the public policies that he's adopted in subservience. In other words, Bush says jump, Blair says how high. Nobody can figure out why. Is it that Bush has an overbearing personality? Is it that Blair has some kind of a need to have the approval of the President of the United States? It certainly couldn't have to do with policy, because in private, Tony Blair is speaking appropriately and correctly about policy. What we're doing is crazy. And as are the rest of many of the other people in his cabinet in private. But in public, they're lining up behind George W. Bush. Meanwhile, the Nuremberg prosecutor says if Saddam is going to be on trial, so should George W. Bush. I'll tell you about that after the break. This is an amazing story. 27 minutes past the hour. The pill that will help you escape the matrix. The Tom Hartman Radio Program. We'll be right back.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Mr. Marvin, middle class, is really in a stew. Wondering what the younger generation's coming to. And the taste of his martini doesn't please his bitter tongue. Blame it on the Rolling Stone.
It's all about the culture wars, don't you know?
It's all about the culture wars.
Yeah, blame it all on the rolling. Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Standing in Jackson Square, a reporter with thinkprogress.org. Standing in Jackson Square on September 15th, President Bush stated, quote, "This government will learn the lessons of Hurricane Katrina." Will? He's still speaking in the future tense? And says he's going to, quote, "get the work done quickly." End quote. Get? Shouldn't it have been done? Shouldn't George Bush be standing right now in Jackson Square in New Orleans saying, look at how we rebuilt this city in just a year. We did it by giving money to local companies who then jump-started the local economy, drew back in people. No. That's not how the Bushies do things. It's not how the Republicans do things. They which crony do we want to enrich because someday our daughter may want to work for them as a lobbyist? Or which company did we used to own or run or be president of? It always comes back to that fundamental principle that the driving philosophy of the modern Republican Party is one of plutocracy and kleptocracy, the idea and of oligarchy. The plutocracy, a rule by the rich. Kleptocracy, well, if you're going to rule, you might as well take whatever you can. I mean, Marie Antoinette had nothing on these guys. And they don't just take what's available. They take what our children have. I mean, they're borrowing from future generations in order to enrich their friends. And the whole idea that the way to jumpstart an economy, the way to build an economy, the way to build a nation is to put money in at the bottom is just, it's like beyond them. It's like they just don't get it. I mean, Bush with his tax cuts. Remember this? I mean, this is like 3 years ago, Bush coming along saying, well, if we give wealthy people a $550,000 tax break, then they'll create a job. No, I'm serious. He said, well, here, you can hear it for yourself.
With a robust package of at least $550 billion and across-the-board tax relief, we will help create more than 1 million new jobs.
Now, you divide 1 million into 550 billion, you get $550,000 per job. I guess GDP figures in order to create a $30,000 or $40,000 a year job, or in the case of Walmart, a $15,000 or $20,000 a year job, you have to give a little more than $500,000, and that's just the way it should be. Makes perfect sense, right? In the Bush world. And it's not just the Bush world, and this is right across the board, the Republican world. The simple fact of the matter is that when you put into place programs that drive money into the hands of working people, whether it's government as employer of last resort kinds of programs, like unemployment insurance or the WPA in times of, you know, from the Great Depression, or whether it's home mortgage deductions for family, whatever it may be. If you can get money into the hands of increasing the minimum wage, increasing the rate of unionization so more working people have decent pay, what you do is you build and strengthen the middle class and you stimulate the economy. Because working people, by and large, are going to spend virtually all of the money they get. They may save a little, but they're going to spend most of it. Whereas you give money to somebody who's already a multimillionaire or a billionaire, they're going to save it. They're not going to spend it. And the only people who benefit from that are those in the industries that, you know, the banking industry or the brokerage industry, who are big supporters of this administration. I mean, this is just such a fundamental point. And it's one that conservatives have, they have somehow captured this discussion in the United States and made it theirs in a way that, it frankly baffles me, how people could have bought this. Yes, let's give rich people $500,000 and hope that they will create one job. Well, the reality is they did, you know, the tax breaks of $550 billion, Bush got them, and he did create 1 million jobs. In China! Because the tax breaks didn't say, oh, you know, here's $550,000. Please create one job in the United States. No. And yet the tax cut package had some fancy name like the Tax Reconciliation and Job Creation Act. So anyhow, back to the beginning of this whole rant. Bush is standing in Jackson Square back in September, saying this government will learn the lessons of Hurricane Katrina and we will get the work done quickly. And you can expect the next day or two, as he stands probably in the same place, he's probably going to be saying about the same thing, because he's going to have to. I mean, here we are, less than half of the city's pre-storm population of 460,000 has returned. So the population of New Orleans right now is about where it was in 1880. A third of the trash has yet to be picked up. Even though they were passing out contracts to clear debris at $23 a cubic foot to Texas companies, who then hired companies who hired companies who hired companies who hired a guy in New Jersey to do it for $3 a cubic yard. I said cubic foot, cubic yard. 60% of the homes in New Orleans still lack electricity. Only 17% of the buses are operational. There's a shortage of over 1,000 nurses, and half the doctors are gone. Only two-thirds of the schools have reopened. 40% hike in rental rates. Who does that hit? Black and low-income families. 300% increase in the suicide rate in New Orleans. And 84% of New Orleans residents rate the government's recovery efforts negatively, while 66% believe the recovery money has been mostly wasted. And there's good evidence of it. Meanwhile, the war goes on in Iraq. I mean, with the money, here we are, we're spending just a little short of $2 billion a week in Iraq. If we spent a fraction of that rebuilding New Orleans over the last year, we could, I mean, go to China and look at what they're doing with Shanghai. Not that they're rebuilding it from a disaster, but I mean, they are building their Beijing. They are building like crazy. You bring some money in, you can do it. In the meantime, we have General Batiste. Now that he's retired and he can speak the truth, he was the commander of the 1st Infantry Division in Iraq Keep in mind, this is the first infantry division in Iraq, right? The guy's on the point. And he's talking about chicken feces. There's a more, vulgar phrase that you can't say on the radio, but you know what it is. And Don Rumsfeld, in the same sentence. Here he is on MSNBC.
Donald Rumsfeld is still at the helm of the Department of Defense, which is absolutely outrageous. He served up our great military a huge bowl of chicken feces, and ever since then, our military and our country have been trying to turn this bowl into chicken salad, and it's not working.
And it's not working. Not working. Meanwhile, Aaron Glantz reports over at oneworld.net, the chief prosecutor, a prosecutor of Nazi war crimes at Nuremberg has said George W. Bush should be tried for war crimes along with Saddam Hussein. This is Benjamin Ferens, who secured convictions for 22 Nazi officers for their work in orchestrating the death squads that killed more than a million people. Told One World both Bush and Saddam should be tried for starting aggressive wars. Saddam for his 1990 attack on Kuwait and Bush for his 2003 invasion of Iraq. The 87-year-old Ferens from his home in New York said, quote, Nuremberg declared that aggressive war is the supreme international crime. He said that the United Nations Charter, which was written after the carnage of World War II, contains a provision that no nation can use armed force without the permission of the UN Security Council. He said the atrocities of the Iraq War, from the Abu Ghraib prison scandal and the massacre of dozens of civilians by U.S. forces in Haditha to the high number of civilian casualties caused by insurgent car bombs, were highly predictable at the start of the war. And you'll recall those of us who were out there saying, no, don't attack Iraq, were predicting exactly what has happened. I mean, this was not rocket science. We were out there saying, this is what's coming down the road. He believes the most important development toward that end, toward the end of prosecuting Bush, would be the effective implementation of the International Criminal Court in The Hague. The court was established in 2002 and has been ratified by more than 100 countries, including the U.S. But on May 6, 2002, about a year before invading Iraq, the Bush administration withdrew the United States' signature to the treaty and began pressuring other countries to do the same. Yeah, so Bush doesn't want to be prosecuted as a war criminal. But I think it's becoming increasingly obvious to the world that he is. 45 minutes past the hour, I'm Tom Hartman.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Hello, mother. Hello, father. Here I am at Camp Granada. Camp is very entertaining. And they say we'll have some fun if it stops raining. I went hiking with Joe Spivey. He developed poison ivy. You remember Leonard Skinner. He got ptomaine poisoning last night after dinner. All the counselors hate the waiters. And the lake has alligators. And the head coach wants no sissies. So he reads to us from something called Ulysses.
Now welcome back, my friends. Hello, mother. Hello, father. Ariana Huffington blogging over at the Huffington Post. According to one trade group representing 2,600 camps and 3 million campers, roughly a quarter of today's children at its camps are taking regular doses of psychopharmacologic drugs such as Ritalin, Concerta, and Strattera for ADHD, Prozac, Paxil, and Zoloft for anxiety and depression, and Clonidine, Lexapro, and Risperidone for mood disorders. She says, we now have over a million kids on Prozac and its equivalents in more than 7 million on Ritalin. Boy, this is not the world that I grew up in. It's just absolutely incredible. We have a school system in the United States that has been the victim over the last 5 years in particular, but I would say, frankly, over the last 20 years, certainly 25 years since Reagan came into office, been the victim of a whole bunch of different special interest groups that want to take it down, from the anti-union folks who want to take it down because teachers are unionized, to the people who believe that everything should be privatized, that the government really has no business running anything, that's socialism, and they don't think that we should have public education, to the people who want to, the fundamentalists who want to control the agenda and what's being taught in the schools. Under Reagan, it was communism being taught in the schools in civics classes, so we don't teach civics anymore, for example. And so we have our public schools under assault. 25 years now, our public schools being decimated by interference, invasions, harassment, and cutting of funding from right-wingers. And so our schools don't work to a certain extent. I mean, interesting, just recently there was a study on charter schools. Turns out charter schools perform worse than public schools.
Gee, what a surprise.
But nonetheless, our public schools compared to charter schools are doing pretty good. But nonetheless, they're having problems. And so we look at the situation and we say, okay, we've got a kid who's not doing well in school. We can do one of two things. We can either put a little extra money into the schools or give the teachers a little more authority and freedom and a little less constraint by federal government that wants to make sure that everybody thinks alike. We can fix the school, or we can take this drug and put it into the brain of the child so that the child's learning styles will match the teaching styles of the school. And tragically, the question has become, which will be more profitable? And the billion-dollar pharmaceutical industry, and I mean, it's a multi-billion-dollar industry, but about a billion of it is devoted just to attention deficit disorder. The billion-dollar give-drugs-to-kids industry has won that debate. Now, I am not a Scientologist, and I'm not opposed to all medications. I'm not even opposed to giving kids Ritalin. But I am opposed to over-medicating kids. I am strongly opposed to it, and my observation has been that a significant minority, and perhaps even a vast majority of these kids who are on these pharmaceuticals should not be. They should simply be in alternative learning environments, or our schools should be appropriately empowered. And we're just not doing that because of No Child Left Behind and because of all the right-wing pressure and because the right-wingers win when the schools crash and burn. Then they can figure out a way to privatize it and take more of your money and put it in the pocket of a new CEO who's going to be running the private school systems, just like our private health care system. We have our health care system in the United States costs twice as much as the health care system of any other country in the world on a per capita basis. And it's produced a lot of billionaires like Bill Frist's daddy and brother and multimillionaires like Bill Frist himself. What's wrong with this picture? And that's the picture that they want to have for us in public education. It's just wrong. 1-866-440-8466. Jude in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Jude.
Hey, good morning, Tom. The Seattle Times last week put out an article that for our upcoming elections, they are short 700 individuals to be in the polls. So I wanted to ask you if I could give you for the Seattle area people to call the elections.
Certainly, for our listeners, yes, by all means. Get ready to write this down, friends.
Okay, it's 206-296-1606. And for individuals that are really concerned about having to lose a day's pay, I want them to know that this is not the motive, but because each day is important, they'll pay $118 a day.
Wow, that's great. So now, if somebody can't remember that number and didn't get a pen fast enough, it's just a King County number, isn't it? I mean, is there?
That's correct. Yeah, King County elections.
King County elections. So they could just call 411 and ask for it as well.
Correct.
Presumably. Okay, great. Jude, thank you very much. Yeah, go ahead.
Tom, my last thing, I have to say this, just listening to all the stuff you're talking about and everything is so shame-filled that's going on. I truly believe that people need to explore American Theocracy and Eternal Hostility, those books, because the problem, I really believe the core is we have a religious supremacist group running, and individuals just think of them as being nuts, and they're not.
No, they're not, and they're very, very powerful. Go over to theocracywatch.org and check that out, Judith.
Hey, thank you, Tom.
It'll curl your hair. Thanks a lot for the call. I mean, if you really want to see what's going on, Theocracywatch.org is we've had the founder of the group on the program a couple of times, and it is just astounding what is being done in the name of religion in the United States. And it's really ultimately all about power and money. Surprise, surprise. The Bush administration, about power and money? Gee, what a novel idea. 875 days, 11 hours, 1 minute, 50 seconds before George W. Bush leaves office, according to the Constitution. We'll be right back.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
We must take from state authority those functions for which it is incompetent and which it performs badly. I believe the state should renounce its economic functions, especially those carried out through monopolies, because the state is incompetent in such matters. We must put an end to state railways, state postal service, and state insurance, like Social Security. That a quote from Benito Mussolini in 1923. Yeah. I'm telling you, this is just so straightforward. The state returned large monopolies to the private sector after returning them to profitability, such as the state consortium of match manufacturers, privatized the insurance system in 1923, the telephone system in 1925, many of the public works. In Germany, the Nazis announced, this from the Nazis announced they would end nationalization of private industries when they seized power. In 1932, Hitler returned control of the Gelsenkirchen Company to private hands, and in 1936 returned the stock of United Steel to private hands. Through the 33 to 36 period, the Nazis returned to private hands the control of several banks, including the Deutsche Bank. In 1936, the steamship company Deutsche Schiff and Maschinenbau were returned to the private sector. In 1934, Dr. Schott, the Nazi minister of the economy, gave instructions to hasten the privatization of municipal enterprises. These enterprises were especially coveted by the rich industrialists, as they had been profitable even during the Depression. Both in fascist Italy and in Nazi Germany, the tax system was changed to one favoring businesses and the wealthy. The Nazis allowed industries to deduct from their taxable income all sums used to purchase new equipment, as is the case now in the United States. Rich families employing a maid were allowed to count the maid as a dependent child and reap a tax benefit. In Italy, the Minister of Finance said, "We have broken with the practice of persecuting capital." The war that's going on in the United States right now has been so often characterized as the value war, the culture war. It's really the war against the middle class. I mean, that's really what it boils down to. In Lebanon, I mean, this is just amazing to just juxtapose these. In Lebanon, as Robert Fisk writes in The Independent, Hezbollah has trumpeted both the UN Army and the Lebanese government, by pouring hundreds of millions of dollars, most of it's almost certainly from Iran, into the wreckage of southern Lebanon and Beirut's destroyed southern suburbs. Its massive new reconstruction effort, free of charge to all those Lebanese whose homes were destroyed or damaged in Israel's ferocious 5-week assault on the country, has won the loyalty of even the most disaffected members of the Shia community in Lebanon. Hezbollah has already won the war for hearts and minds. Most householders in the South have received or are receiving a minimum initial compensation payment of $12,000, either for new furniture or to cover their family's rent while Hezbollah construction gangs rebuild their homes. The money is being paid in cash, almost all in crisp new $100 bills, to up to 15,000 families across Lebanon whose property was blitzed by the Israelis. A bill of $180 million, that would be what, an hour and a half? No, less than an hour in Iraq, the U.S. Army in Iraq, a bill of $180 million, which is going to rise far higher when reconstruction and other compensation is paid. You get this? Hezbollah is winning the war for hearts and minds in Iraq. And yet when we try to do things like this in the United States, oh, let's strengthen Social Security. Let's have a national health care program. Let's make sure that labor is protected by increasing the minimum wage. The conservatives, for the better part of 70 years, get up and scream, oh, you're trying to buy votes. Democratic politicians are just trying to buy votes. Don't you know that a Scottish economist back 100 years ago said that democracies would always fail because over the long term, the politicians who want to buy votes will give all the wealth from the government to the middle class and the poor? So instead, they reorganize government so that it gives all the money from the middle class and the poor to the very rich. Well, that's freedom, don't you know? How can we look at what happened in the Palestinian territories where an organization that is, you know, by most of the world defined as a terrorist organization, came in and said, we're going to build schools and hospitals. And they end up beating, Hamas comes in and beats Fatah, beats an organization that used to be a terrorist organization but now isn't, right? I mean, go figure. But nonetheless, you want to win people's hearts and minds, do for them what they expect government to do. We're not talking about saying, here's some money, sit on your butt. Nobody is suggesting that. Nobody has ever suggested that. You know, as the old cliche goes, the very best welfare program is a job. When Franklin Roosevelt was confronted with millions, I mean, as much as a third of the American workforce out of work, and many of them actually, physically, literally starving and freezing to death? Did he say, let's throw money at people? No, he said, let's create jobs for these people. Let's build the Hoover Dam. Let's build Yellowstone National Park. Let's begin an initial stab at a national highway system. Let's build dams and roads. Let's build railroads. Let's strengthen the railroads. Let's build out the infrastructure of our cities. Let's build schools. Let's build hospitals. And put people to work. Now, Bush understands, the right-wingers understand, that there is some stimulus to be achieved from government spending. After all, they're spending, you know, the government spending under the Reagan administration and government spending under the George W. Bush administration, those two administrations, saw government spending rise at a rate faster than any other administration in the history of the United States except during times of war. The problem is, in both cases, the Reagan administration and the George W. Bush administration, most of that money went to the military-industrial complex. Reagan's Star Wars program that cost $3 trillion, and just by coincidence, he threw this nation $3 trillion in debt. And now Bush's war in Iraq and his perpetuation of Star Wars and all his crony capitalism has cost us another $3 or $4 trillion. And, just by coincidence, we happen to be another $3 trillion deeper in debt. At what point are the American people going to wake up and I mean, it's like it's right there laying around on the ground to see. Listen to the news reports, watch it on TV and say, oh, gee, Hezbollah is winning the hearts and minds of people in Lebanon by building hospitals and rebuilding people's homes. And Israel kind of lost their hearts and minds by dropping bombs on them. And the same thing, the exact same thing is happening in Iraq. We drop bombs on them. They don't like us. The fundamentalists come along and build their hospitals, build their schools, and, gee, they kind of like that. Is this rocket science? But the fascists come along and say, no, 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 no. And I mean that word fascist in the literal sense. The classic definition of the word fascist. Those who would merge business interests with corporate interests. the fascists come along and say, oh, no, no, no. The only purpose for government, beyond police and armies, which we'll help you out with, by the way, is to help the corporations, is to protect the corporations. You say, well, but I thought you were in favor of free trade. No, 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 no. We want you to enforce our copyrights. We want you to enforce our patents. We want you to put people in jail who violate them. You know, I went to the movies over the weekend. We saw the new Woody Allen movie, which is cute. You know, it's a cute movie. And I'm standing outside the theater, or outside the, you know, inside the theater, but outside the movie, waiting for one of our kids to get out of the restroom. And right next to me is this billboard that, or this poster that normally would have a movie preview. And instead it says, videotaping in this theater is illegal. If you see somebody videotaping in this theater, please turn them in. 10 years in jail or some whatever it was, you know, talking about the fines. And you know, you will be prosecuted. No, they want government to protect corporate interests. Shouldn't it be equally illegal to have hungry people in a country? Shouldn't it be equally illegal to have a 5% unemployment rate? Or a real 10 or 11% unemployment? Shouldn't it be equally illegal to have a minimum wage at which a person works a 40-hour week and can't afford to even buy food? 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, Truth in Broadcasting, for a change.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Wake up and shake it up, America.
From north to south, from east to west, from sea to shining sea.
Our government gives a fight for we, the people who can't ignore
that we shall reap what we sow, so we better sow
carefully.
This land is your land.
This land is my land.
If we come together and work together, we can pull the weeds
that threaten to destroy our land. I hope and pray you understand.
We cannot reap a good harvest with a bunch of bad seeds.
And welcome back.
Yeah,
those bad seeds, the Republicans in the House, the Senate, and the White House, 21 minutes past the hour. Congress has allocated $17 billion for Katrina relief. Guess how much of that has been spent? $17 billion. That's $17,000 million. The amount spent? $100 million. The Bushies and the Republicans, oh, we're allocating all this money, but then they don't actually pass it out. And so why? So they can sit around and say, see, system's broken. I'm telling you, this is a very insidious process. Doug Cunningham is with us with laborradio.org. The Workers Independent News. Hey, Doug, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Good to be on again.
I'm great to have you back here. A couple of things in the news that I wanted to talk with you about. The first is this Northwest flight attendant strike. What's the deal?
Well, so far, the judge, the federal district judge in New York, Victor Marrero, has blocked the strike temporarily that was supposed to start today. It was a chaos strike, creating havoc around our system is what it stands for. It's a very unpredictable strike where they hit selectively and not just do a general strike.
Sort of like flash mobs.
Yeah, and you know, it's a very hard strike to defend against if you're a management person because it can be very effective when you don't know where they're going to strike, you don't know how long it's going to be, and you don't know which flights will be affected. So it's a very effective union strategy from the union point of view. But there are legal issues. These flight attendants are covered under the Railway Labor Act, and there are specific rules about strikes. The union earlier had won in bankruptcy court. The judge there refused to block the strike, saying that they did have the right to strike. But this judge has temporarily blocked it while he looks at the legal issues.
Now, Northwest, if this news story that I am reading from is accurate, Northwest is offering its senior flight attendants a pay cut from $42,000 a year to $33,000 a year, along with a 30% increase in the number of hours worked.
Yeah, that's roughly correct. They want $195 million total in concessions from the flight attendants. The flight attendants union says that that amounts to a 40% cut in both wages and benefits when you add all of it up, including more time on the job. And you have to understand this is in the context of a bigger economic earthquake in the airline industry. United, Delta, U.S. Airways, Northwest all have declared bankruptcy. In these bankruptcies and restructurings at American and Continental, workers have given up more than $15 billion in wages, and 100,000 airline jobs have been lost. So it's a big, big issue. And workers are not saying they want a raise. They're just saying that they want cuts to be less harsh while Northwest is in this bankruptcy. And by the way, the last quarter, Northwest earned $200 million in profit, and yet they're still demanding these cuts as if they were completely in bankruptcy.
Well, because they can always use the threat of bankruptcy. The most heavily unionized airline is Southwest, and they're consistently the most profitable. Why is Southwest Airlines heavily unionized, and they pay their flight attendants and pilots very well, and they have good benefit packages, and they don't have labor problems, and they're profitable? And all these other airlines, it almost seems like they're marching to a right-wing corporatist agenda of let's create the appearance of financial problems in order to break the unions so that we can then jack up CEO pay through the ceiling. And is it just that Southwest is run by ethical people? I mean, what's the difference here?
Well, there is a difference in management philosophy there at Southwest, for one thing. And it is true, and it's a very good point to make, that union membership and having a union contract does not mean that you cannot be competitive economically. So airlines, in some cases, and other corporations, too, have been using the bankruptcy laws as a tool, as a bludgeon, to destroy labor unions when possible. And I think there's a little bit of that going on here at Northwest. These workers...
Just a little bit?
Just a little bit. I'm being gracious
okay.
to them.
All right.
But, you know, what's also at risk here for these workers, you know, these gains that these workers have made, the flight attendants, have been made slowly over many years of collective bargaining. When they take this big hit in bankruptcy, there's no guarantee that when Northwest comes out that it will automatically restore them to the level they were at before. So this sets them back many, many years, and that's another issue here. And they've just had enough, and they're ready to strike. And they say that this temporary injunction is only temporary and will only delay them and will not stop them in their strike, so we'll have to wait and see.
We have a little less than a minute left. We're talking with Doug Cunningham, laborradio.org. Real wages fail to match a rise in productivity, the headline in today's New York Times.
Right. Real wages down 2% since 2003. That's the median wage. By the way, that, as a share of the nation's gross domestic product, that's the lowest level, lowest percentage that wages have been since 1947. And this happens at a time of record corporate profits, and it's yet another sign.
And record CEO pay.
Yeah, and it's yet another sign that workers are working hard, increasing productivity, and yet are seeing their real wages go down.
And we still see all across America, you can pick up any newspaper and find a business section, and there's not even a page devoted to labor issues. Not even a page.
Yeah, that's a crime, and we've got to focus on labor news. We've got to focus on what's really happening to working families, and that's what we try and do at Workers Independent News.
And you do a great job of it right over there at laborradio.org. Doug Cunningham with Labor Radio, Workers Independent News. Doug, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks, Tom. Appreciate
the
opportunity.
Keep up the great work. 27 minutes past the hour, the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the pill that will help you escape the matrix.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Telling the truth to multinational corporations. We'd really rather you didn't know all about. Tom Hartman here with you. Our program syndicated by Air America Radio. Mark Carlin with BuzzFlash.com, editor-in-chief over founder of BuzzFlash.com, on the line with us in our best of the rest of the news segment here for the day. Hey, Mark, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon, Tom.
Great to have you with us. Mark, I'm curious, what in your mind are the three biggest stories of the past week, of the past 7 days? What, you know, looking back and today as well?
Certainly, much overlooked by the mainstream press was an extraordinary news conference that President Bush had last week, the beginning of the week, in which anyone who watched it, and Jon Stewart did a tremendous analysis of it on Comedy Central, where you often need to go for the truth nowadays, Bush basically was unglued. He had absolutely no idea what he was saying. He was trying to defend the losing and lost war in Iraq, and there was a momentous question asked, and an even more startling answer by Bush, in which he was asked by a reporter, what connection did Iraq have to 9/11? And Bush said, what? And the reporter repeated the question, and Bush said, none. And this was not a front page story. It was hardly reported at all.
Yeah, here's the clip, by the way, just so our listeners know what you're talking about.
What did Iraq have to do with what?
The attack on the World Trade Center.
Nothing.
There you go.
And it was an extraordinary moment amidst among the many bizarre news conferences Bush had given. This was one where I don't think he had an earphone where someone was telling him what to say. It was just Bush. And you have to wonder what a person who is basically suitable for sitting in the second grade, as he did after 9/11, reading My Pet Goat, is doing running the government of the United States.
Well, he's not doing a very good job. You know,
he admitted that there was what Cheney keeps saying is false, that there's
right.
some connection between Saddam Hussein and 9/11. That's been the major, what they call mirroring, a goal of the Bush administration before Iraq, and Cheney keeps doing this mirroring where he doesn't directly say Saddam was responsible for 9/11, but he implies it. And Bush just said there's nothing to it. And so he's directly refuting his vice president. The second thing...
Before you move on, Mark, let me just add to that, if I may, at that press conference where it looked to me like he was either on or recently off some kind of serious psychoactive medication. He was asked, are you frustrated? He said, frustrated? Sometimes I'm frustrated, rarely surprised. Sometimes I'm happy. That is, but war is not a time of joy, right? So he goes through this, sometimes I'm happy. Well, CBS and the CBS Evening News deleted that out. So the edited quote that was played on CBS Evening News said, frustrated? Sometimes I'm frustrated, rarely surprised. These aren't joyous times, they are challenging times. In other words, they literally edited his take, a video edited. And then the same thing on NBC Nightly News. Laura O'Donnell did the exact same thing, also edited it. The New York Times said that his occasional rocking back and forth, which to me was, you know, a guy who, like I said, either is off his meds or is on too much meds, was a sign that he was, quote, generally upbeat. The LA Times said, quote, Bush's appearance suggested he was settling into a pattern of regular, wide-ranging interaction with reporters in which he can appear confident and presidential. He didn't appear confident and presidential to me. I'm sorry. Maybe I spent too much time being a psychotherapist, but he seemed to me like somebody who's seriously troubled.
I think that was a great indication of how the mainstream press basically serves in the function of what would be for a Hollywood film, the editing function.
Yeah.
They don't record and convey to the public at large what happened. They edit it and make it in some ways an event that didn't happen. In a way, they prop up the president by inflating the image of him through editing. Anyone who saw that news conference, I think if any American saw that, unless they were extraordinarily partisan, if they just looked at Bush as an individual, they would say there is someone there who is unbalanced and unglued.
Yeah.
And the mainstream press, however, dutifully ignored that rather psychotic moment, really, for a press conference, and made it into something that it wasn't.
It was very troubling to me, I have to say. It was very troubling. Anyhow, you said second and third stories here.
The second one, I think, is this continuing issue of little burst of possible terrorist acts on airplanes. I mean, one of the extraordinary things, of course, is terrorist acts could be anything. They could be an exploding chemical train. They could be a building blowing up, as in the original attempt on the World Trade Center when they tried to bomb it from the parking lot. And yet we're fixated, in large part due to the Bush administration, on airplanes. And
well,
we're constantly
today getting, there was a plane that was diverted because they found a threatening note on the
right. And this is almost becoming a state of hysteria at this point, which is how the Bush administration wants it, because the terrorism and the Führer Rose playbook to bypass any rational thought in the American population and get them to vote Republican out of fear. And this is exactly what the terrorists want. We are featuring an editorial today, which is largely based on a story in Wired.com, that says the terrorists win when the Bush administration terrorizes us with terror alerts, because that's the purpose of terrorism. It's not so much even the act. The act of terrorism is to terrorize people through what radiates from the act. And at this point, the terrorists don't even have to do a terrorist act to terrorize us, because the Bush administration does that for them.
Right. I have been in Israel when suicide blasts have gone off. And the first word from the government beyond the news is, you know, get back to normal. It's like, get back to normal. We are not going to be terrorized as a nation.
And Bush is constantly saying that the terrorists hate us for our freedom, and so what he does to respond to the terrorists is curtail our freedoms.
Yeah, it's really bizarre. Okay, the third big story.
Well, the third big story was a rather bizarre one that wasn't noted by the press, but I really think it speaks to the double standard. We had a microscope, even in the Washington Post and New York Times, on Clinton's personal life, but with Bush is largely ignored. There was a report, as distasteful as this may be for radio, in U.S. News and World Report, which was then basically confirmed by White House associates, that the President of the United States, George W. Bush, likes to put it euphemistically, pass gas in front of new recruits, particularly young people working in the White House, just in a way to embarrass them and make them feel uncomfortable, and
right,
that he likes jokes about passing gas.
Right, he likes to fart, and he likes fart jokes.
I'll let you use that.
Yeah, it's a word you can say on the radio.
But again, as someone has pointed out, this is really almost a monarchical way of humiliating people. They come in the room, they're with the President of the United States, and he passes gas and pretends nothing's happening. He likes to see how they'll react. This is extraordinary that the national press didn't pick this up as a key revelation of personality, where they are so concerned about the slightest characteristic in a Democrat as a revelation of personality. This is like first-grade behavior.
They used to examine Jimmy Carter by examining his brother Billy.
That's exactly right. They would put relatives as reflections of a president. But in this case, we have a president of the United States talk about demeaning the White House. I mean, passing gas to pass the time while our soldiers are dying in Iraq, and humiliating aides through that process is really, to me, sort of unspeakably terrifying in terms of the character of the President of the United States. And when you combine that with the news conference, you really have to wonder about his psychiatric state.
Yeah, I think that we're looking at the final stages of, I forget the name, it's named after two psychiatrists. There's a syndrome that is the post-alcoholic syndrome, you know.
So, the dry drug.
Yeah, it's alcoholic dementia. In any case, what do you see as the major story coming up this week, Mark?
Well,
what do you think is going to creep up on us?
Katrina has already, it started last Thursday or Friday, to creep up, and Bush is trying to preempt it by going down to New Orleans. But as someone noted, that's like returning to the scene of the crime.
Yeah.
I mean, Katrina was a pivotal point. I think I recall talking with you on your show last year about this, where we saw they revealed the emperor wears no clothes. And
Mark, pardon my interruption. We only have 30 seconds, and I want to get this out. I am convinced that the Department of Homeland Security had John Mark Carr, or Mark Carr, whatever his name is, the JonBenet Ramsey guy, arrested in Thailand just to divert attention from the story about Bush being convicted, basically, of felonies by Judge Anna Taylor. And Department of Homeland Security was involved in the arrest. Do you think that any newspapers or any media outlets are going to do any investigation on that? Is anybody even going to make a phone call to Thailand and say, was this arrest made at the request of Alberto Gonzalez?
No, because sensationalism sells. This is part of the media that thrives off of a story like this. And we took note of the fact that when the first stories broke, it was Department of Homeland Security spokespeople. But we do think there's an opening for economic issues opening up in the coming weeks. Books like, wonderful books like You're Screwed, that represent the interests of the middle class and how they, there is a war on the middle class, as you say in the subtitle of your book. We think that those issues may emerge. The Bush administration is going to do everything it can to divert attention from those fundamental issues.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
If I had one prayer to pull out thin air, everyone, everywhere would be happy. Yeah.
In a move heavily anticipated for the last 5 years, the National Academy of Historians has ratified what had generally been accepted knowledge and officially demoted George W. Bush to the status of dwarf president. Although Bush stands over 6 feet tall, both the microscopic size of his brain and his total lack of any gravitas immediately disqualified him from the definition of a full-fledged president. As with Pluto, which has been reduced to dwarf status, Bush has a relatively eccentric orbit inclined to 6 degrees of separation from reality. Also, in another parallel with Pluto, Bush orbits around various icy wrecks, including Iraq, New Orleans, and the entire federal budget. Some historians actually recommend that Bush be further downgraded to satellite, given his inability to break the gravitational pull of the neocon solar system known as Cheney Destroyalis. Still others voted to designate him as a mere asteroid. When informed that he had been accorded the same treatment as Pluto, Bush replied that he appreciates that since Pluto has always been my favorite Disney character. Yeah. That from satiricalpolitical.com with thanks. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Fred in Eugene, Oregon. Hey, Fred, what's on your mind today?
Wait, I dislike Bush as much as anyone else, but I would argue that in many, many ways, while people view him as a failure, he has been very successful. He's owns the federal court system. He owns the Supreme Court. He's transferred trillions of dollars to the very rich. He's put cronies in that have made billions. There's no guarantee that he's not going to still own the House and the Senate after the next election, and maybe more important than anything else, he set up a mechanism that's going to ensure control of the House and the Senate and the presidency for the Republicans for God knows how long.
Through redistricting.
He's been very successful.
Now, Fred, you're making a point that I make often on the program, and that is that when you understand the philosophy of these guys, you get it. You know, you really get it. They want all government functions to be privatized, or virtually all. They really and truly believe that if we the people can collectively get together and do something, there really should be a way that somebody can make a buck off it. And so when they break government, for example, Katrina, you know, the Congress appropriates $17 billion, and that's, you know, $1 million 17,000 times, and then FEMA and then the Bush administration and gives it to the Bush administration, and then the administration only spends $100 million of that over the course of a year. You can only say, you know, they're obviously sabotaging this thing. Why? Because they want to be able to point at it and say, see, government is broken.
Like Grover, what's his name, says,
Norquist.
I mean, let's drown in the bathtub.
That's right. That's right.
And
yep.
and they're doing that.
Yeah.
We can make fun of him as much as we want, but he and his Cheney have done what they've set out to do.
Yeah, no, you're spot on, Fred. Well said. Armin in Florida. Hey, Armin, what's in your mind today?
Tom,
you raise a good point, and I'd like to talk about something else if we have enough time. But first, I want to compliment you that you prove, without any doubt, that this carpetbagger regime is nothing but crooks, liars, and deceivers. Because if these people, if they really truly believe the principles that they want to sell to the American public, that their ideology is more pure and better and more advanced than what we've had in the past, and they want to stand with it, they wouldn't have so much payoffs, corruption, and just theft of the capital and the money their way to success.
Yeah, well said, Armin. I mean, the bottom line here is that there is a huge disconnect between the philosophy that they promote of, they call it compassionate conservatism, and the philosophy that they practice, which is...
And the reality of their actions.
That's my point. The philosophy that they practice, which is
absolute fraud.
Is the philosophy of oligarchy and fascism.
Like Ross Perot said this time and time again, if it's a good idea... It'll sell itself without Diebold voting machines or campaign payoffs.
Yeah. Well said. Daryl in Marysville, Washington. Hey, Daryl, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Glad to hear from you. Hey, during one of your commercial breaks, I switched the channel over to Rush Limbaugh.
Mm-hmm.
And you were talking earlier about
Katrina.
It'd
be dangerous to your mental health, you know, Daryl.
Pardon?
It could be dangerous to your mental health. Anyhow.
I just like to know what the other side's doing.
But
we're just about
out of time here, to the point.
Okay. Anyway, he was talking about Katrina, and he was talking about the bloated government not being able to get out of its way.
Right.
And I'm thinking, well, now who's in with the government? You know, it's the Republicans.
Right.
They took FEMA and put it into a bureaucracy.
Yep.
But he's blaming the liberals.
Yeah.
It's a liberal problem.
I mean, what is continually amazing to me is how, I mean, back when the liberals were in charge, these guys could point to any kind of failure or problem and say, see, it's the liberals' fault. Now that the liberals aren't in charge, they still point to any failure and go, oh, it's the liberals' fault. It's like,
oh, it totally is.
You know, it's just a disconnection from reality.
Yeah, he's also complaining about the $2,000 that they gave out to these people.
That Brownie gave out. Yeah,
right.
Amazing. Well, and that's the bottom line. The idea of giving money to individuals. I mean, $2,000. So some people ripped them off for two grand. I mean, you got corporations out there that ripped us off, for billions of dollars. I mean, billions of dollars. Oh. Coming up on tomorrow's program on the Katrina anniversary, tune in and hang on as conservative Dan Gaynor and I debate the role of insurance companies in big business and disaster relief. And Chris Combe, the executive director of the Institute for Southern Studies, is here with a 1 year after Katrina report. That and more and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman radio program, where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. And don't forget, my friends, activism begins with you. See you tomorrow. Tag, you're it.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.